This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my orchestra interview with Mr. Pat Curry. Today is August of 2005. It's 9:05 a.m. Central Standard Time. We're again in the same location in Lubbock in the Vietnam Archive interview room. Pat, let's continue with where we are. You're going to go to Washington, D.C. You've made comments about how that was really not your cup of soup. That was not our cup of tea. That was not where you felt like you had your best part of your career. Tell me what your duties were there, and you had mentioned a couple of names and just the people you've worked for, good and bad, but come on, tell me a little bit about your duties and what you did and why you felt that way.
Well, I was in the office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Logistics for the Army, and I was an action officer, and that was the job title. And that kind of meant you did pretty much whatever came along that needed to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting. It was totally different than anything I'd ever done before, and anything that I would ever do again.
Right. Tell me about first, just kind of maybe a curiosity. What is it like working at the Pentagon? Isn't that kind of For a history person like myself, that sounds really cool. What was it like? I mean, this was the epicenter. This is the epicenter of the superpower of the world. Then two superpowers, now the lone superpower, as the Americans would say. This is perhaps the most powerful building outside of the White House on the planet.
Yes, and I think you're very much aware of that. At a higher level, you know, on an everyday level, you're so overwhelmed with what's going on that you don't really think about that too much. But at a little higher level, yeah, you're kind of aware of that. It's a unique opportunity to be riding into work in the morning, reading the paper, the Washington papers, and seeing what you're going to be working on that day. Mm-hmm. There was the day that Fort Carson, Colorado, ordered an anchor. By mistake, and the supply system functioned perfectly, and they got it. And some muckraker found out about that, so we had to explain that.
Interesting. When you say you read in the paper what you're going to be working on that day, basically world situation, world crises?
Or no, usually some kind of something like Fort Carson, Colorado, 1,000 miles from the nearest ocean, ordered an anchor. Usually it's something like that. But if there is a flare-up somewhere and it looks like we're going to send troops, then yeah. Yeah, you wind up working on that pretty hard, too.
Okay. What kind of security was there?
At that time, there really wasn't a heck of a lot of security. This was before all the terrorism really got started. You had to have a badge, and you had to show the badge to get in, or you had to have somebody sign you in, mm-hmm. Something like that. But there really was not a heck of a lot of security. There was, still is, a big subway station right under the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. It's a major bus terminal for downtown. Mm-hmm. I rode the bus for a while, and then the commute is just a killer.
And where did you all live?
We lived in Springfield, Virginia.
Okay.
So. And it was 13 miles from my front door to the door of the Pentagon. The record was 4.5 hours.
What was the average?
Oh, the average was probably going to work in the morning. The average was probably 1.25 hours, and coming home probably 1.5 to 2 hours.
Wow.
And that's in the HOV lane.
Wow.
Because we were in a van pool, because mm-hmm. we could get in the HOV lane and only take 1.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I mean, you spent so much of your life on the freeway that I have friends that are still there, and I just don't know how they do it. But, when I tell them that where I live, a traffic jam is when it takes you 2 tries to get through the light, they get a little jealous.
But, right.
But the Pentagon was very interesting, and it just... I'm trying to remember some of the things that we worked on. I walked in as a major, mm-hmm. and was immediately handed a $500 million program to manage for the entire Army.
Wow.
And, it was interesting. During my orientation, I met the general who was in charge, and he said, don't forget that while you're here, you can't say, well, the Army regulation, excuse me, call them ARs, mm-hmm. the Army regulation, you can't hide behind those. You can't say, I have to do that, that's what the AR says. Mm-hmm. What you have to do here is decide if the AR is right, and if it's not, rewrite it.
So you're literally at the top looking down.
At the top looking down, yeah.
Well, your budget covered what specifically?
Mine was, it was a spares program. And the idea was is that we would figure out what the parts that were most likely to fail in combat were for tanks and armored personnel carriers and all this kind of stuff, and pre-position them with the units. So that if, as you said, if the Soviets come pouring through the Fulda Gap, mm-hmm. Which at that time seemed like a very real possibility, mm-hmm. Then we would have the repair parts that we needed on hand rather than having to wait for them to come from the States or something like that.
Right.
It was a readiness issue.
How different was this from what you did in Vietnam? I know there's a giant difference as far as size and responsibilities, but the logistics system, had it evolved from your time in country? Or how what was the differences?
Well, the basic structure of having a wholesale and a retail system was still there.
Okay.
And there had been a lot of changes to it in terms of how information flowed and how materiel flowed and those kinds of things. And we worked on some fairly major changes to those kind of systems while I was there, mm-hmm. and so in that sense it was pretty interesting. It was also a time when the vice chief of staff, who was kind of the operator for the Army, was increasing the importance of the National Guard and the Army Reserve,
right?
And so we were dealing with them quite a bit. General Thurman was the vice chief of staff of the Army. So one of the things that we worked on a lot, of course, was the budget. Most of our effort was money based, financial based, and we also wrote a lot of policy. Not a lot of procedures. The operators did more of that, but we wrote the policy for it. Mm-hmm. Now, if it got to be something real hot, then by hot I mean we actually had to send in troops. Then we would get involved and begin trying to marshal materiel and get it shipped and et cetera.
Do you have any examples of when you actually kind of had to go into action?
It was actually a fairly calm time.
It was. This is the mid-80s.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot going on now. A good friend of mine, a guy named Bob Henry, and Bob and I had known each other for years. We worked together at the Log Center working on the Light Division. And he went a couple years after I did. He's a little bit younger than I am. And that's when it was all blown up in South America. He wound up spending a lot of time in Colombia.
Okay.
Helping the Colombians. Mm-hmm. We were shipping a lot of equipment to the Colombians to fight the rebels and the drug wars at that time.
You knew exactly what was going down there as far as parts and just the things that were going on?
Yeah, that office made up the lists. Yeah.
And you saw these lists?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was this... You obviously had to have a security clearance.
I had a top secret clearance, yeah.
Okay, and... Can you comment on what we were sending down to Colombia?
Well, now, bearing in mind, I wasn't there. It was Bob Henry.
Of course.
It was mine that was doing this. But, yeah, it was a lot of individual weapons, M16s, 45s, that kind of thing. A lot of personal protective equipment, we call it helmets, flak jackets, that kind of stuff. And then just some basic stuff, uniforms, boots, just the kinds of things that you would need to equip a kind of a paramilitary kind of force, if you will. It was apparently pretty tense down there. Bob told me he rode to and from work every day in an armored personnel carrier provided by the Colombian government. So,
Can you give people listening to this in the future a sense of the scale of American involvement with logistics, with supply during the Cold War, during the latter years of the Cold War? I mean, I'm not sure if people will understand the scale of what, how much the United States assists militarily, like you said with Colombia as one example, just around the world. What did you, what can you say about that?
Billions of dollars. Mostly, and this did not come out of our office. There was another office that handled foreign military sales, but it was literally billions and billions of dollars. The scale of logistics for the United States Army is hard to imagine. It is everything from, at that time, from a mainline armored division in Europe to one of the things that I dealt with was an Army National Guard unit on a small island in the Pacific. And, of course, everything in between.
Right.
And so the scale is just almost unimaginable. I mean, it's just global, just worldwide. And tens of thousands of tons of equipment and material that has to be purchased and mm-hmm. distributed and paid for, those kinds of things. It's just really kind of hard to imagine, hard to describe. And it's, you know, there's a lot of changes now. The Army now, a lot of things that the Army used to do for itself, we now contract out. There's a lot of stuff in Iraq that the Army used to do that we now hire contractors to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the big U.S. companies. I'm talking about local Iraqi companies.
Right.
That we'll hire them to come in and do construction or, put in phone lines or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduces what's called the logistical tail. Mm-hmm. And that's an old term, and it just means that how much does it take to keep a soldier, an infantry soldier, fighting? How much of that stuff is behind him?
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of it in terms of a pyramid, with the infantry soldier at the point mm-hmm. and this big broad tail behind him
mm-hmm.
because you have not only the logistics that you have to consider, the supply, the maintenance, those kinds of things, ammunition, you have medical care, you have personnel, you have to keep other guys' personnel records up, you have finance,
mm-hmm.
Everybody has to get paid. All those kinds of things, and all things considered, the Army just does a heck of a good job.
What can you say about waste? Were things efficient, or was there a lot of waste that you saw?
I wouldn't say a lot. There certainly was some. I think in an operation that size, I think there's going to be. And if you know, I worked for a general one time. This guy was kind of interesting. He had actually been in a concentration camp in Germany in World War II mm-hmm. as a child.
Wow.
Yeah. And he wouldn't talk about it, but understandably, I think.
That's
but, anyway, he said, I want my logisticians to be efficient. He said, I want my fighters to be effective. And there's a real difference in the two. And, of course, what we tried to be as loggies, if you will, logisticians, was to do both.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, our whole focus was to make the fighters effective. And, being efficient was not the first priority. If you're looking at preparing for a major ground war, it's not efficient to have millions of dollars worth of repair parts sitting on the ground not being used.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at preparing for a major ground war,
mm-hmm.
that is an effective way to operate, if you see the distinction that I'm
drawing.
And yeah, there was some waste. When you've got a million of one particular piece of equipment and it's spread all over the entire world, it's a little difficult to keep up with it.
How do you keep up with it?
With great difficulty.
This is all computerized.
It's computerized now. At that time, it was computerized at the higher levels, but the guys in the field had what was called a property book, which was a hardback book with pages, paper pages in it, and that's what you used to keep your inventory. It was all pretty much a manual thing. A lot of emphasis on what we call property accountability. Mm-hmm. Careers were broken over property accountability.
That's so.
When we went to the command course that I told you about, they said, well, there's two things that'll get you relieved. One is zipper problems, which means a battalion commander fooling around with younger women, younger lieutenants. And the other is losing property. So there was quite a bit of emphasis on it. And, of course, there were several major scandals about the Army not knowing how many of a particular piece of equipment they had. But it was usually people on the outside just kind of taking pot shots, in my opinion. I thought we did a pretty good job, all things considered.
Tell me how you worked with civilian contractors. How did the Pentagon and the logistics of the Army deal with that venue?
It's really kind of an interesting setup and kind of a good setup. We had, and I'll divide the world into two parts. One was we had Department of the Army civilians mm-hmm. who worked in there with us. And they were the continuity. They were there. They stayed there.
Inside the Pentagon.
They actually worked in our office. They were action officers just like the military guys. Mm-hmm. But they were the continuity. They had the institutional memory. They knew what had happened 5 years ago. They were the guys that could come in and say, well, you know, we tried that same idea 5 years ago and it didn't work.
I see.
And then the military would come in for a 1 or 2 or 3 year tour. And we brought the knowledge, the experience in the field, mm-hmm. the operating experience in the field, and a lot of enthusiasm. It wasn't just a regular job to us.
Right.
So between the two, it was actually a pretty good mix. We had, you hear a lot about civil service and they're kind of dead on their feet and et cetera, but mm-hmm. well, we had some really talented people in that office, some really knowledgeable, really expert people in that office that knew what they were doing. We had our 10%.
Sure.
We had some people that, that just kind of basically showed up most of the time. But the majority of them were pretty good, dedicated people. In working it, we called it the building, capitalized.
Uh-huh.
We never called it the Pentagon. It was the building.
Uh-huh.
It was a good experience. It's not something I'd ever do again, but it's funny. A lot of guys avoid that their whole career. It has a bad name among the active duty military.
Why?
It's called the Puzzle Palace and that kind of thing. It is very difficult to sit down and write a policy that applies to an armored division in Europe and a National Guard unit on an island in the Pacific. And that island in the Pacific, that's a real thing. That happened to me.
Really?
Yes, really. That's why I use that as an example.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was trying to write an Army policy on a particular part that was recoverable.
Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, what we found was we were getting rid of a lot of them that the unit level maintenance was trying to repair them and fix them, and they weren't able really to do it. So what we were trying to do was move the maintenance level for this particular item up mm-hmm. one level to a support level maintenance where we had more expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to write a policy for that. Well, for an armored division in Europe, that's pretty easy because your direct support maintenance is right down the road.
Mm-hmm.
This guy sent me a message that his direct support maintenance was on another island 1,000 miles away, and could he please have an exception to policy?
It's a legitimate concern.
It is a very legitimate concern, and certainly one I never thought of. Mm-hmm. So we kind of laughed about that one, but we certainly gave him the exception and let him continue to do his own.
Right.
So that's a real life example kind of thing.
Interesting. Interesting.
And so anyway, if you're trying to write those kinds of policies, and the guy says, well, you know, we can't possibly do this. So it kind of gives the Pentagon a bad name. And,
right.
So like Mike Ellicott, my boss, he retired as a full colonel, and he told me, well, he said he never wanted to go to the Pentagon. And I thought it would be a good experience, and I thought it would be career enhancing. And it was an interesting experience. I won't say it was a good experience, but certainly it was interesting.
Why do you say it was, before today's conversation, you were saying that it was really not something you enjoyed.
It was not. I did not enjoy it. And as I mentioned, I certainly, if I was to go back, I wouldn't do it again.
Why?
I just didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it.
Even with the increased responsibility and working inside the Pentagon?
Yeah, even with that. Like I said, it was interesting.
Sure.
I won't say it was ever boring. I worked a lot of 24-hour days. But it's not something that I'm particularly good at. I'm good at the shorter range, more operational kinds of things. And although I did very well in the log center, but like I say, it wasn't something that I was good at. I did not enjoy the politics. I had to laugh. My boss, Colonel Guest, he had been there, I guess, about a week. Found himself in the desk box limo riding to Capitol Hill to meet with the congressman, and he thought that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And but
how did politics enter into your job?
Oh, well, a lot of office kinds of politics. You had the Army Materiel Command over on the other side of town. You had the Pentagon here, and you had various activities in town, and there was a lot of machinations going on and maneuvering and who's going to look good for the desk log and the chief and those kinds of things, and I'm not smart enough to do those kinds of things. I didn't care about those kinds of things, and I'm not good at those kinds of things, and that was just one part of it. And I just got kind of a little bit overwhelmed, too. I mean, it's like trying to sip out of a fire hose. There was just so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had not learned to pick out the half a dozen most important and work on those.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. So you eventually are going to move out of that position. You're there for 2 years, is that correct?
Well, actually, yeah, I was there actually for about 2.5. But what happened was I started going off to the various pre-command courses.
Mm-hmm.
I was selected for battalion command while I was there.
Mm-hmm. Which is the next natural progression, is that correct?
Well, no. Battalion command is a competitive thing. They actually have a selection board that meets and reviews performance appraisals, OERs, and selects battalion commanders. And I was fortunate enough to be selected. I mentioned earlier that I had been a battalion maintenance operations
yes.
officer and an XO. That really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
The experience, they figure if you've been an XO, you've been pretty close to command.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good experience to have, and those kinds of things.
Did Vietnam play into any of this at all?
Now, by then, Vietnam was so long ago.
But it was only, 12, 13 years before?
Yeah, but that was a long time. I mean, in a 20-year career,
sure.
Sure. That's a long time.
So, long time for you or long time for the U.S. Army to kind of back?
Both.
Hmm.
Both.
Was there talk about what we did wrong, quote-unquote, in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and let's not make that mistake again?
Not by that point.
Nothing like that?
Nah. By then, we were back focused on Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Our focus was beginning to, I'm trying to think of a good word, fray a little bit.
Right.
Trying to convey that we were starting to look at other areas, South America, Central
mm-hmm.
America,
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of places. The smart guys were looking at the Mideast, those kinds of things. But we didn't think about Vietnam very much at all. At least we didn't talk about it.
Did you think about it much?
No, not really. You know, it's one of those things I kind of tucked away
mm-hmm.
and didn't bring up much.
Even as the movies were coming out, the books were coming out still, and you just kind of put it away?
Yeah, by then there was not a lot of coverage of Vietnam. The big thing then was the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And I did go there several times. And
you have very strong feelings about the wall.
Yes, I do.
Tell me about, you weren't there for the opening ceremonies
No.
and all that,
No.
but you arrived in Washington just two years after it was erected.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your first visit and your experience there.
I went, and the first thing, I'm looking for it.
Were you by yourself, or was it a night?
No, it was during the day. Diana was with me, and the kids were with us, mm-hmm. and we were, you know, kind of sightseeing like you do in mm-hmm. Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go see the Vietnam Memorial, and I couldn't find it. I wandered around. Where the heck is it?
You knew where, generally?
Generally where it was, you know, and I expected a monument. And finally, we went down below ground level, and there's this black wall, and, you know, there's nothing that displays the heroism. There's nothing that displays the dedication, you know. There's nothing that says that Chip Chandler was a hero. It's just this wall with the names of all these dead guys on it. And it's hidden. And no, I don't like it. And I think they did a much better job with the Women's Vietnam Memorial. You know, it shows what those women did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were women killed in Vietnam.
Yes.
And this says, their monument says they were heroes. And ours just kind of says, well, they're dead.
That's interesting.
And so, no, I don't like it.
Were you verbal about it then?
No. You know, it was I don't want to say stunned, but I was so shocked and overwhelmed by being there and disappointed. That's the word I'm looking for. I was so disappointed with it, you know. But I didn't really at the time, really didn't really know why. It took me really several years to kind of figure out, why am I so disappointed, and, you know, why do I have such mixed feelings about
mm-hmm.
this? You know, one of the big monuments there is the Marine Memorial. Excuse me. Guys raising the flag on
yes.
Iwo Jima.
Yes.
You drive by that, no matter how many times you drive by that, you know, it just kind of, your heart kind of swells a little bit, and you kind of think, man, there's the heroes.
And it's very visible. It's right there off the road, just across the Potomac in Arlington.
Yeah.
It's quite visible.
Very visible, and the Marines are good at that. And, you know, they put it right out there, and thousands of people see it every day, you know, and it's a constant reminder of what those guys did.
Mm-hmm.
And the wall is just, it's just not there. It's not, you got to really look for it, for one thing. You know, it was a real disappointment, and it is a disappointment to me to this day.
How many times have you been back to see it?
Oh, half a dozen. And I've seen the visiting wall, the traveling wall, several times. It remains a disappointment to me to this day.
Did you find Chick's name the first
oh, yes.
time you were there?
Oh, yeah. I find that every time I come. Mm-hmm. I go look at that every time. I never made a rubbing of it, but...
Yeah,
I find him every time I go.
Anybody else that you look up?
No, just him. Just him.
Your interpretation of that wall and your response is very different from a lot of veterans. They see it as a great monument to the fallen heroes. But what do you think would have been a more appropriate monument? And I know I'm putting you on the spot with that, but what do you think that the Vietnam War monument should look like? Or as general?
It should look like dirty, sweaty guys in ripped fatigues in a firefight. That's what it should look like. It should look like guys going up Hamburger Hill. You know, it should look like guys being heroes,
mm-hmm.
Because that's what they were. And you know, they did things they didn't have to do because that was their job.
Mm-hmm.
And and we should celebrate that. And we didn't. And I understand the context. Don't get me wrong. You know, that when that wall was designed, it wasn't that long after the war, and the war was still an open, raw, bleeding sore for America.
Designed by a young Vietnamese woman.
Yep. And so you know, it's not something we wanted to put in the forefront of our national thought. We didn't want to have it really visible like the Marine Memorial and those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And I think because of that, we really shortchanged the guys that, not just the guys that died, but all the guys that fought over there.
You're talking about millions of men and women who were in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and they shortchanged them all, in my opinion.
Right.
For what that's worth.
Well, this is what this is about. So tell me about leaving the Pentagon and leaving Washington.
You know, they gave me a little farewell luncheon, and I told them, I said, you know, I've actually had two tours of the Pentagon, first and last.
Did they all understand?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was pretty verbal that I was not happy, and I wanted to get back to what I considered to be the real Army,
mm-hmm.
And they knew that. Plus, I was going to a fantastic assignment, battalion command.
And that was in Germany?
In Germany.
Okay.
And so they had various and sundry pictures, and I specifically asked for one that showed the picture of the Pentagon in the rearview mirror. I was glad to be leaving.
Right.
And as I say, I didn't do poorly. I just didn't do well.
Mm-hmm.
The general that I worked for, you have two people who write on your performance appraisal, two or three, but two that are important. One is your immediate rater. That for me, that was Colonel Guest. And then the next guy up was the general. And the Army evaluation system is, we've struggled with it for years and years. Nobody wants to be responsible for ruining somebody else's career. And so there's inflation. You know, if you give a numerical rating, everybody gets 100. You know, and it makes it very difficult to look and say, John is better than Bill, so we're going to promote John, we're not going to promote Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So the Army, several years ago, came up with a new system.
Mm-hmm.
And you have what's called a senior rater profile. And if I start getting into stuff that you want to talk about, just tell me.
Oh, no, go ahead. This is interesting.
And what it is each senior rater, and I was one for quite a while, you have a profile where it shows where you rated people. And in theory, it's going to look like a diamond. You got very few people at the very tippy top. You got very few at the very, very bottom. And the vast majority come in the middle, what's called center of mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you rate somebody, you put them somewhere in this diamond.
Mm-hmm.
And they monitor your senior rater profile at DA. And if you start getting too many people at the top of the pyramid or the top of the diamond, mm-hmm. they write you a nasty little letter.
Mm-hmm.
And it has turned out to be an extraordinarily effective way of managing performance appraisals.
It seems that they can quickly look at someone and say, okay, yeah, Pat rates a lot of people at the top, so mm-hmm. one, we're going to write him a letter, and two, will they...
His OERs, the ones he writes are not going to count as much.
Exactly.
You know?
Is this still in effect today?
Well, I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's been so many
sure.
years, I can't imagine they would have changed it. It works so well.
Sorry, that was an unfair question.
When your OER goes to Department of the Army, the MILPERCEN, Military Personnel Center, they put on there for that senior rater. You know, I've written an OER on John Smith.
Mm-hmm.
That OER gets to DA. And on John Smith's OER, they put Pat Curry, his senior rater, has rated three people in the top, seven people next, 20 people in the middle, what we call center of mass,
right?
3, 2, 1, whatever. So you can tell just by looking at that piece of paper, at John Smith's OER, exactly where Pat Curry, his senior rater, has rated everybody he's ever rated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a totally foolproof system. When I wrote the first OER, senior rater OER I ever wrote, you know, I had no profile.
Right.
Well, it turned out to be on a real good guy. But how do I show that? Well, you show that in the words.
Right, right.
And there's different sets of words that you use, you know, and to convey to the promotion board what you really think about this guy.
How much favoritism is in this process?
At what level?
Okay, at the level where you are.
Not a lot. I think most of the guys that I know or knew and myself, we took that responsibility pretty seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty conscious of my senior rater profile. I didn't want any nasty letters. So I was pretty conscious of it, and I rated most guys center of mass. And, of course, that always hurts their feelings. You know, nobody wants to be average. And center of mass guy under normal circumstances is going to get promoted.
Okay.
Okay? But may or may not get selected for command and general staff, college, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it always hurt people's feelings. But, you know, it was a good system, and we felt a real responsibility to make it work.
Was it anonymous in any way? Did they know it was, they knew it was you. They
Absolutely.
Knew who would be writing.
Absolutely. You always know. And the Army started something that was really good in the past, before they started this system.
Mm-hmm.
An officer didn't necessarily see his OER. If the raider didn't sit him or her down and say, here's your report, they never saw it unless they went to DA and looked in their file. And that was just wrong on so many different levels. You know, the good officers always took the guys they rated, sat them down, said, here's your OER, let's talk about it.
Right.
Not all did.
Did you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was one time when I didn't, and I should have. But anyway, that what they changed about the system was that when it processed through the local personnel office, they made a copy and sent it to the officer. So they always got to see it, even if the rating officer didn't sit down and show it to them.
Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
When you write recommendation letters now, or when you did, you know, in your civilian career after the Army, did you let those folks see what you had written?
When you wrote
recommendation letters.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Same, you want them to know what you
absolutely.
Said.
Absolutely, yeah. One time I didn't do it, and I really regret it.
Now, in the Army?
In the Army, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But since the Army, you when you write the letters, you mm-hmm. let them see it. Is that basic?
And typically, the way I do it now is I'll write a letter, and I'll give it to the individual and let them pass it on or do what they want with it. Most of the requests you get now for references are on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the world's kind of divided into two parts. If they're not really somebody I would recommend, I cut and run. I say, well, I'm sorry, you know, the school rules are I can't really discuss them. All I can do is confirm that they were worked here. But if they're somebody good and I really want to try to help them out,
mm-hmm.
then I forget the school rules and give them a good recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I see.
But to get back to where we were in the Pentagon, the general up there was somebody who was still putting everybody in the top block. And the first time he rated me, I was in the top block. Pretty much along with everybody. Well, he went and sat on a promotion board, saw how important the rating system was, came back, gave us all a big speech about how important it was and how he was going to start adhering to the system.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a mechanism whereby if your senior rater profile gets out of whack, you can reset it, which means that you stop history. Everything that has gone before is still there, but you start over.
When can you do that? Anytime?
Anytime you want. All you got to do is write a letter. So if I look at mine and discover, well, you know, I've really put too many people in the top, it's getting skewed, I need to reset it, I can write them a letter and I start all over.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of doing that, he just started rating people lower to try and put more people in the center of mass.
And you got...
I got in the center of mass lower. I'll put it that way.
So it looked like you had just started to really underperform.
Yes.
And
I have not forgiven him. And I certainly wasn't the only guy. that this happened to. It happened to a lot of guys. And what he should have done, you know, ethically, morally, for the Army, was reset his senior rater profile. I might have come out in exactly the same place.
Do you really think you would have?
Probably. Yeah.
Well, didn't people know that this general was in that situation, that he had not written the letter and started over, and all of a sudden now he started grading everybody, or was it too soon for them to really
know? Oh, it was really too soon for them to know. And there's, you know, they're looking at, when they're sitting on a promotion board, they're looking at thousands of reports.
Yes.
Thousands. And now I have a minute or two with each one to look. So
it's got to be really tough. Pat, is this why you were passed over as colonel, do you think?
No. Two reasons. One was, and frankly, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but
of course.
I didn't, in one particular area of being a battalion commander, I didn't do particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
And my OER showed that. But what happened was, the wall came down. It was obvious that without the Soviet Union, it was going to be a much smaller army. They really cut back promotions.
Mm-hmm.
And before then, if you had commanded a battalion successfully, you were going to get promoted to colonel. That was just a given.
Mm-hmm.
But when they cut the promotions back so much, that stopped. And in fact, the guy, Bob Sidlow, the guy I had worked for when I was an XO, was at Milpherson, and he told me a year earlier I would have made it easily.
Huh.
And the only time in my life I've ever been too young. And what they do is they come up with an order of merit list. They take everybody who is eligible for promotion and they rank them.
Right.
And then and that list goes to Milpherson. Milpherson says, we need 752 colonels next year. They can't count down 752 mm-hmm. names, and they draw a line.
Mm-hmm.
If you're above the line, you get promoted. If you're below it, you don't. Well, when that number that they needed got so small, they drew that line much higher. There were several friends of mine who had also commanded and who did not get promoted. But I was crushed. I was destroyed.
Really?
Oh, it was just, I mean, I can't begin to tell you how horrible that feels.
Mm.
And even with, to this day, it's something I have never been able to get past. Part of it was a self-inflicted wound, but part of it was just history and circumstances. But a friend of mine phrased it as it's like a spear through the chest, and the way it is, too. Because, I had every expectation of getting promoted.
Of course. So. You have dedicated your life thus far to the Army and served well, it seems.
It sounds.
You've done everything you needed to do to put yourself in that position.
And it was a difficult time for me, and it's something that, to this day, which is ridiculous. I mean, how long ago was that? But I just have not been able to get past it.
It's ridiculous. I would think that it's probably normal to be regretful and to have some feelings about that. That's a major shift in your life. We kind of skipped over a really important, interesting time period in your Army career. So when you did go to Germany the second time, tell me about where you were stationed, your duties, and what you saw.
We were, I went over to be a battalion commander, second best assignment I've ever had.
First being the
company commander in Vietnam.
Yeah,
no question. I had made a personal mistake, when they asked what battalion did I want to command, I picked the 66th Maintenance Battalion, and that wasn't a mistake. It was a damn good unit. The guy before me, Charlie Bush, had done a great job. I didn't have to come in and clean up a big mess.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie had done a great job, and Charlie was another one. Incidentally, they got caught in the drawdown.
Mm.
He had all the jobs to be a general.
I remember the newspapers and the stories and everything about this drawdown.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what they call it, the peace bonus.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And but Charlie had all the. I thought he was going to be a general for sure. He'd been a battalion commander. He came back states, was a division support command commander, went to senior service college, the whole works, and, mm-hmm. And retired as a colonel. I thought for sure he was going to be a general, and probably should have been. But
when did you get to Germany? This was in 86 or 87?
86. And anyway, got over there. Oh, let's talk about made a mistake. What I should ask for was a forward support battalion in a division.
And is this hindsight talking?
Hindsight talking, yes, okay. Absolutely. 2020, perfect hindsight. And should ask for a forward support battalion. Don't know that I would have got it because my experience as an XO and an operations officer was at the general support level. Of maintenance, that's where my experience was, probably what I would have got, but I should have fought for a forward support battalion.
Instead, you have a rear support battalion.
Yes, and don't get me wrong, great battalion, great people, but wasn't my mindset, but anyway, got over there.
Where?
We were in Kaiserslautern, which was in central Germany near the French border.
I think you've spelled that once before.
K-A-I-S-E-R-S-L-A-U-T-E-R-N. Kaiserslautern.
Okay.
Very heavily Americanized community.
And whereabouts again?
It's in central Germany.
Okay.
Near the French border.
Okay.
And I say very heavily Americanized. Lots of Americans there. A lot of Americans retired in that area.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They marry a German woman or decide that they like Germany, and they stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had great facilities and, you know, a nice hospital, nice PX. And
did the girls come over with you?
No. Actually, what happened was they pass on quarters from battalion commander to battalion commander. I had to give him time to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over, and Diane and the girls closed the house in Washington and came over just a couple of weeks later, three or four weeks later.
Okay.
So I didn't have to batch it very long. First time I went over, it was like 6 or 7 weeks before I got quarters. And there were guys that had been there 6 months waiting for quarters. But anyway, so Diane and the girls came over. Then fortunately, they got there in time for the change of command, and which is a big ceremony.
Yes.
And so we had the change of command ceremony. Was a terrific job, and I think that I did a pretty damn good job, frankly. You know, it was kind of interesting. Your company commanders, the young captains, what they're focused on is the mission. They want to get the equipment repaired,
mm-hmm.
and get it back into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And at our at our level, what we did really two things. One was we would, for some customers, we would repair their equipment and give it back to them. That's called direct support.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a general support mission. And what that means is we would take equipment that had been taken out of a unit, put back in the supply system. The system would give it to us. We would repair it and refurbish it, put it back in the supply system,
mm-hmm.
to be reissued. But we wouldn't issue it directly to a customer.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And we had several German units. CSG, civilian support groups, who did the majority of the general support.
Mm-hmm.
And but the young captains were focused on that mission, getting that piece of equipment repaired and getting it back. I was focused on training. The maintenance mission was secondary. We were really there to be prepared for a war. Now, for our units, there were two pieces to that. One was getting the equipment repaired, getting it back in the system so it was there if we needed it for a war. But the primary reason was to train and be ready to go to war.
What kind of war were you training
for? Ground war in Europe. That was our focus.
Okay.
That one of the things that we did was rewrite our war plans. And that was our focus. If the Soviets came through the Fulda Gap, what did we do? Now, we were so far back. I mean, we were almost in France.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we were behind the rear, and almost. And that was our focus. So it created some interesting discussions between the company commanders and myself, with them saying, you know, I'm spending so much time training, I don't have time to do my mission. And me saying, Captain, you don't understand. Training is your mission,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And you're supposed to prepare.
And so that was a continuous mm-hmm. tug of war and kind of thing. And, and the CG, General Louis, his focus was also on training. And I agreed with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what kind of typical duties did you have? Just kind of overseeing this entire training process?
Well, you know, making sure that they were doing the training when they were supposed to. My S3, the operations officer, would come up with a training program, making sure that they implemented it, making sure that they were training on the things they were supposed to be training on.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical training, wearing the mop suit and the protective mask and that kind of thing. In the training context, going out, observing the training, making sure they were doing what they were supposed to be doing when they were supposed to be doing it, that they weren't just out there playing grab ass, that they were doing something productive.
Right. You were Lieutenant Colonel?
I was a Lieutenant Colonel,
okay.
Yeah.
Training in the sense that these are logisticians training to back up the infantry, basically, and back up the ground war. Is that correct? Is that?
You're a soldier first and a logistician second.
I see.
So during the dedicated training time, what we trained on was basic soldier skills.
I see.
Okay. The set of skills, the set of knowledge that every soldier has to have to be a good soldier. How to set up a Claymore mine. How, if a chemical alarm goes off, to get your mop suit on, your protective suit, well, you probably had that on anyway, but mm-hmm. to get your boots and gloves and mask on in a minimum amount of time. Basic fire and maneuver. Now, we didn't do anything near what the infantry did.
Mm-hmm.
Real basic fire and maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
We would go out to the field and set up a perimeter and defend that, just as a basic soldier skill. How to do repairs in the field, not in a shop. Those kinds of things.
Tell me, that all makes very, very good sense. But tell me how, this is the midst of the Cold War, and at this time, the very end of the Cold War. What was the atmosphere like? And people who didn't live through the Cold War, and especially post-World War II, not necessarily the first 5 to 10 years, but really kind of after the Vietnam era ends, you know, say early 70s, that threat of kind of a nuclear blanket hanging over the world, that as a child I was practicing in junior high school to prepare for a nuclear attack,
mm-hmm.
a real one. Now, what was the atmosphere like amidst all this training in Germany, right there on the front lines? I mean, right where it's going to happen first, most likely. What was this? Were you all very conscious? Obviously, you are, but are you thinking, wow, nuclear war could happen anytime? Something could, a hot spot could happen here or there around the globe and trigger. Something happens with the Koreas and it triggers a confrontation here. What was this atmosphere like?
That was always there. That thought was always there. And, you know, personal basis.
Sure.
I frankly didn't worry too much about a nuclear war. I figured if there was going to be a nuclear war, we were dead.
Really?
Yes. There wasn't anything we could do about it.
Did you tell Diana this?
Well, Diana knew it. We used to have, and I'm trying to remember what they were called, but we used to periodically have exercises where they would practice getting all the dependents, all the family members together, take them to the airport, load them on an airplane.
In Germany.
The plan was when the threat got to a certain level, when the DEFCON got to a certain level, they would evacuate all the dependents.
What does that do psychologically to your children? I mean, I know that's a necessity, but are you saying now, listen,
it made them a little tense.
This is what's going to, know, Daddy's going to stay here,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to glow in the dark
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are getting out to live without
him. They weren't nearly as worried about me as they were about the dog. Diana was very upset that they weren't going to be able to take the dog. But as a battalion commander's wife, she participated in, the kids participate in these exercises all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just one of those things that came with being in the Army in Germany.
Mm-hmm. So and, you're very aware of this.
Oh, yeah, it's always there. And one of the things that I did was back in the Reagan days when we had enough money, I would, one company at a time, I would get them together, load them on a bus, and send them on a border tour.
The border tour of the Germanies?
Of the Germanies, yeah. The 11th ACR, which is one of our crack units, gave border tours.
ACR, standing?
Armored Cavalry Regiment, sorry. They were the frontline unit. They were in the Fulda Gap. And come over to my office sometime. Mike Ellicott's got a good picture of from the 11th ACR perspective. It's a painting, but it's a good picture of looking across the border, which is a bunch of flat space with barbed wire everywhere, and towers.
Mm-hmm.
But I would send them on tours that the 11th ACR gave of the border.
Why?
Because I wanted them to know that the threat was real. You know, we were way away from it, but, you know, I wanted them to know it was real, it was there, we were here for a purpose, we had a real mission. And, you know, there were bad guys right across that wire, and they could decide at any time to come through that wire. And I wanted them to know that. I wanted to raise their awareness, if you will, heighten their awareness mm-hmm. Of that. And I think it worked. The feedback I got was that, you know, geez, we had no idea. And so I think that was a reasonably effective thing to do. But that awareness, I think, was always there. Like I said, I didn't worry about a nuclear war. I mean, that, like you said, we were all going to glow in the dark. That was going to be it. Excuse me. What I worried about, I didn't worry about an all-out nuclear war. What I worried about was a more conventional war, maybe tactical nuclear weapons, but almost certainly a lot of chemical weapons.
Really?
Soviet doctrine called for the use of chemical weapons. I mean, it's just,
mm-hmm.
that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly were going to use them first. There was never any doubt in my mind about that.
Nerve gas and all of that.
Yeah, and nasty stuff.
Yes.
Nasty stuff. I was always scared to death of that stuff. And we trained a lot on that. A lot.
Were you aware that you've got Soviet satellites watching you guys train and watching all this happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We used to get periodic briefings of what we called SMELM, a Soviet military liaison mission. By the terms of the peace agreement at the end of World War II, the Soviets had the right to send observers anywhere in West Germany. Now, they had to meet certain... technically had to meet certain requirements. Their cars had to be marked and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We had the same right in East Germany. The military, U.S. military liaison missions. And but we would get briefings. They were only allowed in certain areas. And if we saw them outside these areas, we were supposed to try to stop them. Of course, they didn't want to be stopped.
As in shoot and kill?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. Try to block their vehicle.
I see.
Try to, you know, get them sandwiched in so they couldn't stop and call the military police and those kinds of things. It was like a big game.
Did this actually happen?
Oh, many times.
Really?
Yeah, it was very routine. And we had to report any smell of them that we saw anywhere, even if they were in a legal area. And there were several times we had convoys going out to a training area and we'd have smell them behind us or alongside us or something like that on the Autobahn. Yeah, it was very common.
What did they look like?
A black car with, you know, Soviet hammer and sickle on it and that kind of thing.
What did the agents look like?
Oh, just people.
Just regular folks?
Just regular.
Not uniform?
No. Well, sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes. It's very unique. Supposed to be in uniform, but
it's very unique.
But you know, they weren't the stereotype of the Russians with the one eyebrow, real thick and
sure.
It's
sure.
just ordinary people,
right?
And just doing their job like we were, but they were the bad guys.
What'd you think of the Soviet Union then?
And God, I was scared to death of them. I mean, there were so damn many of them.
Yes, yes.
You know, and there was a real difference in philosophy between the Soviets and us. Their philosophy was a lot of relatively inexpensive equipment. Their equipment wasn't very sophisticated, but the theory was it would run forever, didn't need much maintenance. We had the opposite theory. We wanted fewer, very capable pieces of equipment. Like the M1A2 tank is just an extraordinary piece of combat equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a real difference in philosophy. But we knew if there ever was a ground attack, that, man, there was going to be a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had divisions of artillery.
Yes.
I mean, it's just, you know, around Berlin there were 5 tank armies just circling the city of Berlin. And so we knew, man, there's going to be a lot of them.
And you knew that artillery was going to try to take out logistics systems and support units just as quick as they were trying to take out the front line.
Absolutely. We figured where we were, I'll put it that way, I figured we were going to get a lot of chemical. Because over time that would dissipate and they'd have our facilities to use.
True, very true.
And in personally, chemicals one of the things that scared me. So we trained a lot on chemical. And it paid off. It's funny, it paid off. I got a call after, several years later, I got a call from one of the guys who'd been a company commander for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been in touch with one of the NCOs.
Mm-hmm.
And this NCO had gone to Desert Storm. And the NCO told him, he said, you know, there were a lot of chemical alarms because we thought Saddam was going to use chemicals during Desert Storm. And this staff sergeant told his captain that, he said, you know, he said, when those alarms went off, I was always the first one in my mop suit. He said, Lampertheim paid off. Lampertheim was a training area we used to go to.
Okay.
And I would
How
have...
How do you spell that?
Lampertheim. Okay. Lampertheim. It was a training area. He said, Lampertheim paid off. And I would make the battalion chemical NCO. He loved me because he was oriented on chemical warfare, and I made him do a lot of training. He loved me. But I would have him set off chemical alarms 3 or 4 times a day, make people get in their mop suit.
Wow.
Just to practice.
Wow.
And it worked. It paid off. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I was always 3 times faster than anybody else. We had trained on it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it paid off. Mm-hmm. It benefited the guys. And you know, that was the point. They have to survive to do their job, and I wanted them to survive.
Did you ever handle logistics with nuclear weapons at all?
No. No, that's a very specialized field. I frankly wanted nothing to do with it. You know, one comma out of place will end a career. And that's a slight exaggeration, but not much.
I understand. That is sensitive. And
oh, is it ever. And so, no, I never had anything to do with that and never particularly wanted to. One of the big things that went on while I was there was, trying to remember the name of the missile system, but Reagan was moving a new missile system in. Golly, what was the name of that?
But it was in the United States, or moving it over to Europe?
Moving it over to Europe, and that was a big flap. The Soviets were mad. Of course, the French were mad.
I remember what they
said. And one of those battalions moved on to our installation. And, you know, you can see your target rating go from a 12 to a 2.
Right. Did you all say, hey, why don't you take it about 60 miles out?
Yeah. We tried, but it was no go. And so that was kind of an interesting time. And
speaking of Reagan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, man.
Yes. When he went to Berlin and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, what was your reaction? I don't remember exactly what year that was off the top of my head, but I think, were you there?
I really don't remember. I remember my reaction is, go Ronnie. You know, we were right with him.
I mean, he's in East Germany saying that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your...
And it worked. They tore down the wall.
Yes, they did. So tell me about your experience in Berlin and with the end. Before that, though, I want to hear what the West Germans were like, how they treated you as Americans, and did you meet East Germans before the wall comes down?
When we were in Kaiserslautern, mm-hmm. you know, the West Germans really were ambivalent about us. On one hand, they knew that we were protecting them from the Soviets.
Do you think they really understood that? I'm playing devil's advocate.
I understand, and I think they understood it. I think they didn't want to, if that makes any sense.
It does.
And they knew that we were a major economic factor for them. On the other hand, they really didn't want us there. Can you blame them? You know, if there was a German armored division in Lubbock, I probably wouldn't be too thrilled either. But, of course, the government, the German government, we were absolutely indispensable. They paid us major bucks every year to help support the United States Army mm-hmm. in Europe. A lot of people don't know that the Germans contributed a lot of money.
Billions of dollars.
Billions to the upkeep of American forces in Europe. But the average German on the street, they weren't too crazy about us.
Did you speak German? Did you learn it?
I spoke some. I went to a language course before I took command, and so I spoke some German. I wasn't real fluent, but I could get along. And the area where we were at that time was so heavily Americanized that it was really kind of difficult to meet Germans and socially. Most of the Germans that I knew, in our battalion we had several German units that we called civilian support groups that I mentioned a few minutes ago. These were that really interesting piece of history. They were leftovers from the end of World War II. We had, at the end of World War II, there were millions of displaced persons. Mm-hmm. And that had no home, nowhere to go, no work. And the Allies, not just us, but the Americans as well, started these civilian support groups. And what they were civilian units. They wore uniforms, but they were totally civilian. And at the end of the war, these units had been made up, the ones in my area had been made up of Polish DPs, displaced persons. And so these had been Polish speaking, their officers were Polish, their workers were Polish, and we put them to work for the United States in non-combat type capacities, mm-hmm. like repairing equipment and those kinds of things, mm-hmm. as a means of giving them a way to make a living. We built barracks for them. They lived in barracks, military housing facilities.
On the base.
Kind of. Some of them, yes, some of them, no. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
And these units had been in existence since the end of World War II. And there were a lot of them in our area because of where we were. Mm-hmm. As you got further forward, you didn't see them. But back where we were, there were a lot of these units. Over time, they had been open to Germans, and it was a good career path for a German. A young man would come in, go into an apprenticeship program, and I had a place to live, had a mess hall to eat in.
Learn a skill,
and have a job. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of Germans in these units by this time.
Were they paid by the U.S. government or paid by the German government?
Gosh, you know, that's a good question. I do not remember.
Okay.
And I should know that, but it was so long ago, I just don't remember.
Go ahead.
But anyway, of course, these guys had been there for years and years and highly skilled. I mean, they were good. And they could fix just almost anything. And by this time, most of the Polish guys had retired. and the majority of the units were German.
How did you get along with these
guys? Oh, great. They were good guys. They were used to us, you know. The American commanders come and the American commanders go, and we're still going to be here, you know.
Right.
And but while we were there in another unit, up the road from us, there were two Polish guys who were getting ready to retire, and one of them, in all the years since the end of World War II, had not been off the base.
Wow. Why? How?
Just, I guess, scared. But he had his little niche, and he was comfortable. And he had never been off that base in all those years. It was in the American paper, the Stars and Stripes. It was in the German papers. It was, because everybody was just so amazed. Mm-hmm. And everybody was kind of wondering what he was going to do when he retired, because he couldn't live in the barracks anymore.
Right.
And it turned out to be a non-issue. We found a little place and moved in. But, yeah, it was. They were kind of interesting. And a lot of the Germans that I knew were the guys in these units.
Right.
We'd go out to their homes and their clubs. They had a little club in their building and that kind of thing. Good guys.
It sounds very interesting, where you could really kind of touch the local culture there.
Yeah.
In a very safe environment. Yeah. Very safe way.
It, well, Germany was very safe anyway.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we never worried about that. So.
What about East Germans?
You know, it we were not encouraged to get in contact with East Germans, either by the U.S. or by the East Germans. I had one incident, and it's funny, the guys that really loved us were the older East Germans.
Why do you say that?
They were very sorry they had been caught on the east side of the wall. But many times when we were in East Germany, East Berlin, I should say, we had to go in uniform, so we were always in uniform. I learned very quickly not to wear my hat with the scrambled eggs on the bill.
Why?
Because I attracted lots of company. They figured if you had scrambled eggs, you were important. Scrambled eggs being the gold braid on the bill of the hat of a field grade officer.
Yes.
It's the ones you always see in the movies.
Yes.
You always attracted lots of company, people taking your picture and following you around. They weren't at all subtle about it. It was the Stasi.
The East Berliners.
The East Berliners, yeah. This is why you were in East Berlin.
You could go over, do a tour, come back.
By the terms of the agreement at the end of the war, Berlin was divided into four parts. Berlin remained an occupied city up until the time the wall came down. It was officially the only occupied city in the world. And it was divided into four parts, French, British, American, and Soviet. The Soviets had about the eastern half. The western half was divided among the Allies. And by the terms of the agreement, we could go over there anytime, and we had unrestricted movement in East Berlin. And we went over there quite frequently.
Americans in general or American military?
American military.
Right.
Now, American civilians could go, but it was kind of a hassle.
Yeah, checkpoints.
Everybody had the checkpoints.
Right.
Passport, visa, yeah. The whole works.
Yeah.
But by the terms of the agreement, we didn't have to have any of that stuff, and they couldn't ask us for it. We couldn't ask them for it either.
Right.
But, of course, the number of East Germans that were allowed to come our way was pretty small.
Yes,
so.
Yes. Tell me about Berlin and the atmosphere there and what it was like. I mean, this is an incredible, you're right there. You don't know this is getting ready to happen, the wall coming down, but you're right there on the cusp of history once again, right in the middle of it.
What an amazing place to go. I mean, just, there was a friend of mine, when I was finishing up my battalion command tour, there was a friend of mine who was in Berlin at the time. Well, I had called Milpersen in Europe and said, okay, I'm getting ready. What assignments are available? And they said there was one available in Berlin. Well, this friend of mine was there and recommended me to the command, Danny Bransford, and recommended me to the command, so they took me on. They had the right to accept or refuse anybody. The U.S. Army Berlin was really a favored child. And when I say accept or refuse anybody, I'm talking down to the privates. Before somebody went to Berlin, the Berlin command would look at their file. If they had an Article 15 or anything else, they didn't come. They were, every one of them, handpicked. But, so anyway, they recommended me to the command, so we went to Berlin. And there were two ways we could get into Berlin. One was to fly. And, in fact, when I went for an interview, a friend of mine in the aviation battalion flew me in. You had to be, as an aviator, you had to be certified to fly the corridor, they called it.
Yes.
There was one specific corridor in and out of Berlin, and U.S. aircraft had to stay in that corridor. And he needed a flight to maintain his certification. He was battalion commander of the aviation battalion, so he personally flew me in and out of Berlin.
And what kind of airplane?
It was a... Gosh, a small fixed wing. Okay. That's all I remember. But so when I went, I was by myself. Diane and the kids were still in Cape Town, and driving that ground route for the first time is an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. There's a very strict protocol that you follow. Mm-hmm. We never officially recognized East Germany.
Right.
So the guards on that side were Soviets. And there was a very strict protocol. You go out to this point, you stop, you make a right face, you take X number of steps. A Soviet enlisted man will meet you there. You exchange salutes. He looks at your papers. You exchange salutes. You turn around, go back in your car. Or conversely, depending on where you were, you go in this little building, you put your papers in a slot. You never see the guy on the other side of the wall. And pretty soon they come back out of the slot. Then you go outside and go through the exchange of salutes and everything. Periodically, a door will open, and a hand will come around the wall, and it'll have a Soviet belt with a Soviet buckle on it or something
really?
Like that.
Why?
They want to trade.
Oh, okay.
They especially like Playboy. But you take the belt, put something in their hand, they would disappear. You never saw a face.
Now, this is purely just friendliness.
Just purely friendliness, curiosity.
Yeah.
They were as curious about us as we were about them.
So would you take a Playboy magazine? And
I never did, but I knew a lot of guys that did. I was always afraid as a field grade that if something blew up, it's going to be nasty.
Sure,
and,
sure.
But what the thing was, if you were coming through, you put a Playboy on the dashboard, and that meant you wanted to trade.
Really?
And they had to be a little circumspect because there were cameras just everywhere.
Yes.
Ours and theirs.
Yes.
And so, it was kind of...
Very interesting.
Kind of humorous in a way.
What did you see traded from the American side?
Playboy. Okay. A belt. Although our buckles were just plain.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs had stars and hammer and sickle mm-hmm. and that kind of thing on it. So.
That's really neat. Really neat.
And it was interesting. But the first time I went through, I was pretty nervous.
Oh, yeah.
And you're always afraid you get off the Autobahn. There's an Autobahn that goes through East Germany to Berlin. And periodically, somebody will make a wrong turn. They give you the U.S. side of the border will give you a book. And it had directions, it had pictures, it had everything. You had to try pretty hard to get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And about once a month, somebody would get off the Autobahn and wander around in East Germany until the East Germans or the Soviets picked them up. Most of the time, they'd take them back, put them on the Autobahn, send them on their way. Once in a while, depending on the political situation, they'd make a fuss or something.
Mm-hmm.
But technically, we were not allowed to deal with the East Germans because we'd never recognized them.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little card, and it said, it translated it in German, and they had it in German, "I want to see a Soviet officer."
Huh.
And what you were supposed to do is sit there with your windows rolled up and hold this card into the window.
This is if you were stopped for any reason?
If you were stopped for any reason. You're not allowed to deal with the East Germans. "I want to see a Soviet officer."
Did you have to use your card?
Never. Never. We drove the corridor many times and never had a bit of problem.
Wow.
So you drove this corridor in, but it was really interesting. There was, there was a real sense of fatalism about it. I mean, there were five tank armies around us. We had a brigade. How long were we going to last?
Right.
We did a lot of joint planning with the State Department about how our big mission was to keep the corridor open, and about how we were going to take a unit and go through the corridor, an armored unit, and go through the corridor and fight our way out, etc. We did a tremendous amount of training in urban warfare. In fact, everything was funded by the German government. Everything we did. And we lived well, let me tell you. That was our showplace. In order to maintain face, if you will, the West Germans and the East Germans, both the center sides of Berlin, were real showplaces. I mean, my sedan, my Army staff car, was an Audi. I had a five-bedroom house. I had turned down a three-story, seven-bedroom house.
Wow.
At the end of the war, the Americans took over that part of Berlin. The first thing we did, of course, was throw all the Nazis out of their houses, and we took them over. And we still had these houses all these years later.
So you're saying when you went to visit Berlin, you stayed?
Oh, no, no. This was when we moved, when we were living there.
You actually moved into Berlin.
I'm getting things confused. I was battalion commander at Kaiserslautern.
And then you went?
And, yes.
I see.
So when I turned over the battalion,
I see.
My next assignment was as the G4 and director of logistics. G4 is the senior logistics officer and director of logistics for the United States Army Berlin. And the first time, when I mentioned flying in, that was for an interview.
Right.
To see if they wanted me. And then when I drove the corridor, that's when I was going to Berlin to take my job. At that time, I was the maintenance division chief. And later got to be the G4 and the director of logistics.
Just tremendous responsibility.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In a very small microcosm.
Sure, but at the epicenter of, literally the epicenter of the Cold War.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so I'm sorry, I kind of got things confused there. I turned over the battalion, went to Berlin, and like I said, there was a real sense of fatalism about it. I mean, we did all the planning. We trained and trained and trained and trained and trained. I mean, the infantry guys there were probably the best urban combat guys in the world. I mean, they were just good.
Was this all the Americans, or were you working with the French and the British as well?
Well, I was referring to the Americans. We worked very closely with the French and the British.
They had their people there as
Absolutely.
Well, their military there. Mm-hmm. How well did you all get along?
Very well. Very well. They'd come to our house. We'd go to their house. My British counterpart was a British major, really, real good guy. My French counterpart was a Moroccan French lieutenant colonel. French know how to live. I mean,
what do you mean?
Oh man, they had the most beautiful officers' club. It was right on the edge of a lake, and just beautifully appointed and very well done. Their quarters were huge and very well furnished, and of course, excellent wines. We used to love to go to the French PX and commissary, and they didn't come to ours very much for some reason, but. I guess Spam and potato chips didn't feel to them very much, but yeah, we got along quite well. And in fact, I got an invitation to the Queen's birthday party. You know, they have an official birthday in June. Doesn't matter when the Queen's real birthday is. They have an official Queen's birthday party in June.
Queen of England.
Queen of England. Yes, I'm sorry, the British counterpart. Mm-hmm. And we got invited by the Brits to the Queen's birthday party. Fergie was there. And it's really interesting, as Americans, we don't see much royalty, and it's really interesting seeing how royalty is treated. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Fergie sat on a dais out in front of everybody else, raised up, shaded, and everything else, and the British commanding general was sitting behind her and to her right, as she watched the parade go by for the Queen's birthday and everything, just a really
interesting
experience.
Very interesting.
Went to a big reception afterwards, and a big part of it was all roped off, and nobody could get within 100 feet. That's where the royalty was, and the British senior officers. And then they had a corridor roped off, and when it was time for her to leave, she walked down that corridor. Very gracious lady, at least publicly, and our British counterpart said she was really nice.
She was young.
Very young. And they offered her a piece of cake. She was touring the British facilities, and our British counterpart, his wife, who hated Americans, was telling us about this.
Really? She hated
Americans? Oh, really hated Americans. Why? And made no bones about it.
Why?
I don't know. Huh. Never did. Never know. But he was a real nice guy. Mm-hmm. But she was telling us they offered her a piece of cake, and she said, you know, I'd love to, but I just can't. You know, they were really giving her hell about her weight.
Yes.
She said, if they see me with a piece of cake, I'll be in 15 newspapers tomorrow. And,
wow.
Yeah.
What a way to live.
Yeah. And I mean, just, I mean, under a microscope all the time. Mm-hmm. She came across as a very nice lady and mm-hmm. very gracious. So.
Good. Let's take a break for a minute.
Okay.
Okay, Pat, continuing. Tell me a little bit about East Berlin.
Very interesting place. You know, the older East Berliners loved us. We had freed them at the end of the war, more or less.
The end of the World War II.
World War II, yeah. And, you know, we were kind of, compared to the Soviets and the East Germans, we were kind of the beacon of liberty, if you will, to use a cliche. But I'd go over into to East Berlin, and we had unrestricted right of access. Mm-hmm. We could go anywhere in East Berlin, and we did. But we'd go over and walk around, and the older East Germans were always very warm, very welcoming. One time I stepped in a mud puddle. Of course, in uniform, I stepped in a mud puddle, and an older German man came rushing over. I thought he was going to get down and clean my shoe. I really did. Now, the younger folks, different story.
What did he do?
He just came over and was very upset and that I had stepped in this mud puddle and grabbed my arm to steady me and my elbow to steady me and the whole works. And just,
wow.
Yeah, it was a good experience. Mm-hmm. It was a very good experience. And we had several of those with the older folks. The older folks would always smile and, you know, doff their hat or say hello or something like mm-hmm. that. And, so it was pretty interesting.
What about the younger generation?
Not so much. But they had grown up under that system. That's all they knew. They had no basis of contrast. And it was the same in West Berlin.
Yes.
The older West Berliners loved us.
Yes.
And but the younger West Berliners, Berlin was an interesting place in many, many ways. But one of the things was they started many years before having a real outflow of people from Berlin. The population of West Berlin started to decline very sharply, and the West German government was very concerned about that. So they put in some real incentives to live in West Berlin. Among them was a free university, a completely free university, Freie Universität. And if you lived in West Berlin, you were not subject to the German draft.
That's big.
That was huge. There were many taxes that West Berliners did not have to pay that West Germans did, and a couple other things. So, and that was very successful in getting the population of West Berlin back up. And but look at the kind of people that it would attract: people who didn't want to be drafted, you know, the free university. So it was a very pacifist. I'm talking about the younger generation.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Very pacifist society, very anti-war, and to some extent anti-U.S. military. Mm-hmm. And so,
despite the fact that, looking back at history, they were freed from, or quote unquote, freed from Nazism and fascism. And
well, the big thing was that keeping the Soviets out. And keeping the East Germans out, and that's what the older folks who could see how the East Germans were living,
mm-hmm.
They knew what we had done. They appreciated it. The younger folks didn't have that basis of comparison,
right?
And so
this is, I mean, you were a young boy during the Berlin Airlift, mm-hmm. and those elderly Germans, when you finally, you know, were there as in your mm-hmm. career, they lived through that.
They lived it.
Yeah.
And in fact, the pilot, one of the pilots who flew in the Berlin airlift, they had a big celebration every year, and he would come back, and he was a real hero in Berlin.
Yeah.
I mean, understandably.
Sure.
He was the candy pilot. He was the guy that would throw candy out the window to the kids.
Yes.
And every year he'd fly over and throw candy out. But he was real, to this day, he was a real hero in Berlin.
How was Harry Truman played in Berlin?
No, I never heard really much about him. The big guy was John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
JFK.
I am a Berliner.
Exactly. And he was the hero, statues, pictures, everything. But East Berlin, they tried to make it a showplace. But it was all external. And
the Soviets
tried very hard to make East Berlin the showplace of communism.
Did the East Berliners try, or was that pretty much imposed upon them, according to what you saw?
Well, you know, you figure that the younger guys up to, what, 30, 35, had lived under that their whole life. It's all they knew.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was their town, their city. They tried to participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was an East German doctor who was, and East German doctors made good money just like ours did. He had all this money in his bank account. He was very frustrated. There was nothing for him to buy. I mean, there was a real shortage of goods on the East German side. We were instructed never to buy food, not a restaurant meal, but at a grocery store on the East side, because it was so scarce, we'd literally be taking it out of the mouth of East Berliners.
Mm.
Many times we'd walk down the street and we'd see something nice, some piece of leather goods or something like that in a store window, and go in only to find out we couldn't buy it. It wasn't for sale, it was just to put in the window on display.
Wow.
They had one, and it was the display item, and it was not for sale. And that was not unusual at all. Many, many empty store windows. Now, right downtown, in the very center of town, there was a huge department store. And they had pretty good selection of stuff. And, of course, the prices, the exchange rate was such that, with Ostmarks, Eastmarks, and exchange rate was such that stuff was really cheap and really inexpensive. And so we used to go there and buy the consumer goods, and there was a lot of stuff that they made specifically to sell to tourists, Christmas kind of things, and although no religious symbols,
right?
Obviously,
right.
But you know, the traditional symbols, reindeer and Santa Claus or Saint Nick and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we could go over there, and there was a restaurant we used to go to, and it had survived the war, so it was a very old building. It had the very ornate, and I remember this so clearly, very ornate sculpted plaster ceilings. And I'd say an old building, and there was never any money to renovate it, but it was not in bad shape. But we could get a full 6-course dinner with Russian champagne, wine, and dessert for about $4.50. And
wow.
That's with live music.
Wow.
And
you and Diana would go over?
Oh, yeah, frequently. And if we had visitors, and when you live in Berlin, you get lots of visitors.
Yeah, I bet so.
And if we had visitors, we'd take them there for dinner, because it was a neat place.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they weren't even subtle about it. There was in the light sconce, there was a big opening, big hole. That was clearly a microphone and a camera. I mean, they weren't even set up.
Wow. where was this camera? In the restaurant?
In the restaurant, yeah. Yeah. You'd be sitting at in a booth, and the light sconce would be mounted on the wall.
Would you wave to it?
All the time. Yeah.
Would you make any other gestures?
No. And, when you were on the phone, when you were in West Berlin, and you were on the phone in your quarters, all the phone lines ran through East Germany, of course.
Yes.
And you'd hear clicking and buzzing and that kind of stuff. And we'd say, hello, Ivan, and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And we had some secure lines in the office.
Yes.
But at home, you just assumed you were being listened to and were a little careful with what you said. But it was intensely interesting. And then when the wall started to come down, it was just madness, just chaos.
Tell me about that time period.
Well, we were on alert. The U.S. forces were just on alert because we had no idea what was going to happen. This is when Gorbachev essentially came on and said, you know, the war's over.
Yes.
We're done. We're finished now. And, of course, he'd been building up to it with Glasnost and Perestroika, but now it was happening.
This is 1989.
89 and 90, yes. And
so this is a kind of a slower procedure that you guys are on alert for a longer time before the wall, or was it an emergency?
It was really, you know, it's funny. It moved very, very slowly, like cold molasses for a long time. And then all of a sudden, it just fell off a cliff. And when it started, it just happened like that in a matter of days. We could see things happening on the east side. We noticed a lot of the border guards were gone.
Mm-hmm.
We noticed when we went over to the east, things were very different. And what we ultimately found out was the Soviets had essentially said, you're on your own, to the East Germans. And I'm trying to remember the East German premier's name. I can picture his face. I can't remember his name.
Can't see.
He was a little weasel.
Not Volta.
No.
Kurt Volta.
No. He was the UN guy, but gosh, what was it? I just can't remember his name, but you know, the Soviets told him, sorry, you're on your own now. And the Soviet military forces all pulled into their garrisons. They were not out and visible anymore. Shortly thereafter, they started pulling back to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But, so it got pretty tense because the East Germans, you know, the Soviets had kind of a vested interest in stability. But the East Germans were really kind of a loose cannon. And we really didn't know what they were going to do. I mean, without the Soviet military behind them, we weren't too worried. But nevertheless, we didn't know what they were going to do.
They could cause an incident, or maybe, yeah, move into the West, or
yeah,
do something.
A big bloody one.
West Berlin.
You know, or, you know, use the armed forces to keep their folks in and us out, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
And, but then the East Germans got in on the act. And I've got a tape I should bring in for you to play. It was made by a Berliner right after the wall came down.
Mm.
The East Germans got in on the act, and they started getting pretty active. And, in fact, there was one big night where they had congregated on their side of the Brandenburg Gate and were coming up to the wall, and a bunch of East German soldiers were there to keep them, and did keep them from crossing the wall, right at climbing up on it and crossing
yes.
over right at that point.
Yes.
And that really started kind of a groundswell. And pretty soon the East German soldiers were as much a part of it as the civilians. And that's when the wall really started to come down. I'll never forget the West Berlin police arrested a guy on the West German side who was out there with a sledgehammer beating on the wall. I mean, they were so ready for that wall to come down.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there were guys out there with jackhammers and everything trying to tear this thing down.
And this thing was very heavily constructed.
Oh, it was, yes. Yes, very heavily constructed. But of course, on the West Berlin side, you could walk right up to it.
Right.
Now, on the East Berlin side, you couldn't do that. There was always a dead zone.
Right.
But on the east, on the west side, you could always just walk right up to it. People were hammering on it and chipping it. We went down to Checkpoint Charlie. It sounded like a boiler factory. Tink, 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 tink. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were hundreds of people down there chipping on the wall.
And this was night after night, or this one intense night?
No, well, all along. There was about a 3 or 4 day period where this was going on.
What were you doing? Did you go down to watch?
We went down once, but we were on alert, and the USKOP, the U.S. commander of Berlin, had put out orders that we were not allowed to go down and chip on the wall or anything like that. And so we had to kind of stand back and watch. But we were just kind of waiting to see what happened. Like I said, we had our forces on alert. The infantry guys were in their barracks. And we were just kind of waiting to see what was going to happen because it was very uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And then just all of a sudden, the East German Honecker.
Yes,
that was
yes.
his name.
Yes.
The East German premier. And he was a real hard-line guy, too.
Yes.
And, of course, the Stasi East German secret police, mm-hmm. think Gestapo, mm-hmm. Worked for him. Mm-hmm. And but all of a sudden, he was trying to hang on. Honecker was just trying to hang on, but all of a sudden it just collapsed. I mean, it was like a house of cards, and you pull one card out, and it all collapsed. The East German army disappeared. The Stasi vanished, because they knew if they got caught, they were going to get strung up. They broke into the Stasi headquarters, the East German crowds, and ransacked the place. All the entrances through the wall opened up. The border guards went away. I mentioned that we drove through Checkpoint Charlie, never got slowed down. There were no guards there. Before, there had been a very rigid protocol to go through. You had to pull up to a certain place and you stopped and you stared straight ahead, because we couldn't acknowledge the East Germans. And they would walk around the car and inspect, but they couldn't talk to you and you couldn't talk to them. They were not allowed to touch your car. And when they waved you through, you drove on through. But this time, after this, you just drove on through. There was nobody there. And the other openings were unmanned as well. And, I mean, it just came down just like that. And the East Germans came flooding over to the west. And you would see them walking back. The West Berliners, the West German government, had a policy called, I can't remember, but something Geld, which is money. But when a East German or East Berliner came to the West, they could go to any bank and get 100 West German marks, just like that, just for being an East German or East Berliner in the West. Huge long lines down the street of people who. East Berliners who would come over and wanted their Gruskill. Gruskill, is that right? I don't remember, but I mean, the lines were so bad that the West Berliners were going out and passing out coffee and cold drinks and that kind of thing, and we were flooded with refugees, and they had these little cars. Excuse me. Tiny little two-stroke cars, mm-hmm. and I mean, they were built out of fiberboard and fiberglass and plastic, and got the air in East Berlin was just horrible. And it was god awful two-stroke engines, so they were pouring all this crap into the air, and it was brutal. Mm-hmm. Never forget, as the wall was coming down, I had to go take a PT test. Well, we hit all these little Trabant cars, and with their little two-stroke engines, they maxed out about 45, and they had come over to the west, and the air was just so bad, and I had to do a two-mile run. Mm. My lungs burned for 3 days. Mm. I was a lot thinner then, but we got this huge flood of refugees who wanted to surrender to the Americans. There was this one couple, friends of ours, young enlisted couple, and they were sitting there one day and a knock on the door, and it was an East German who wanted to surrender to them.
Oh, gosh.
And wanted them to adopt him, you know.
Right. But they didn't have to surrender.
No, they didn't have to surrender. There was no surrender involved. That's probably a poor choice of words. But
To kind of turn himself over.
Turn himself over, yeah.
But your
thousands of these coming to the U.S. forces, trying to get under our control, and we set up tents and camps for them and all that kind of stuff. One guy. Tried to surrender to, we had one unit that I can't talk a lot about that was a very high security unit, and he tried to surrender to them. Turned out he'd been lieutenant colonel in the Stasi, and we figured he wanted to be a mole. So we arrested him. We didn't take him as a refugee, we arrested him.
Right.
But we set up all these camps. Never forget. We had to find a Vietnamese interpreter. There was a fairly sizable group of Vietnamese who had been taken from Vietnam and brought to East Germany as laborers, East Berlin as mm-hmm. laborers, and were in essence slave labor. I mean, they had no choice in the matter.
Yeah.
As soon as the wall came down, they hooked it over. Well, this was 30 years later. Vietnamese interpreters were in pretty scarce supply. Mm-hmm. It took us 3 or 4 days to actually bring one in from the West.
Did the refugee camps, did it touch your logistical system at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were running our butts off trying to find tents and food and all of that kind of stuff. It really stressed the system. Most of it we rented or purchased from West Berlin vendors, mm-hmm. contractors, but we also brought some stuff in from the West as well.
Wow.
And we were just flooded with people. And then one thing that they did is when these Vietnamese came over, the Vietnamese government went to the East German government and said, you cannot allow this. And early on in this process, they still had to come through a checkpoint. And the Vietnamese coming from the East after that point were turned away. They were not allowed to come. Mm. The first few were until the Vietnamese government got involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stopped the Vietnamese from coming through. Wow. And we wanted to talk to the East Germans, but we didn't know who to talk to at that point.
Right.
And I'm getting the chronology a little mixed up because I'm just telling rambling incidents here. But
what years were you there in Berlin?
I was in Berlin from 88 to 90.
Okay.
And but we were just flooded with refugees. And of course, we still didn't know what was going on, didn't know what was mm-hmm. going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in the process, they would let anybody with identification papers through. And eventually the checkpoints just went away and it was just unrestrained.
Mm-hmm. Tell me then, this is the end of the Cold War.
The end. We won.
Tell me about that. Why do you
think we won? What a feeling. What a feeling. We won. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union had abandoned its key ally. The East German people were in charge in East Berlin. They had raised the Stasi headquarters. What they wanted to do was get the secret police files. The Stasi had files on many, many, many people. They also made it very, the people, no government, the East German people, made a very concentrated effort to find out who the Stasi spies were. You know, one of the basic tenets of the KGB was, you know, telling your neighbor, well, that got passed on to the Stasi.
Yes.
And the East Germans wanted to find out who those people were.
Yes.
And when they found one, it wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
Several of them got beaten to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, they were just in chaos. Nobody knew what was going to happen with the Soviet Union, but it was rapidly collapsing, even that early.
Mm-hmm.
Countries were declaring their independence. And, you know, I had one telling, at least to me, very telling experience. We took a tour and went to the house where the peace treaty was signed at the end of World War II, which was in East Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And they had English-speaking people there, but this was a Soviet enclave, not an East German, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was run by the Soviets. Well, there was a lady in there who spoke excellent English, and she gave us the tour. And at the end, we said, "Spasibo," you know, thank you, and that kind of thing, and, which is pretty much the extent of my Russian. And we got to talking to her, and we called her Russian. Oh, she got irate.
Was she Ukrainian?
She never did tell us, but she let us know in no uncertain terms that she was not Russian.
Hmm.
And she made very sure that we understood that. I mean, she made that crystal clear.
She's very telling.
She was pissed mm-hmm. that we had called her Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had no way of knowing.
Right.
But, wow. I mean, obviously, very strong feelings about making it clear she was not Russian.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a very interesting
Absolutely.
Interesting incident.
It's very telling.
And but anyway, as time went on, when the wall actually officially came down, they closed downtown Berlin. Berlin was a party town anyway. I mean, it was just a wild place. And the young guys just loved it. Of course, they bombed that, the terrorists bombed that disco and, a couple years before and that kind of thing. But they closed the whole downtown to traffic, mm-hmm. automobiles. And it was just one big street party. And, I mean, everybody was kissing everybody else. Everybody was hugging everybody else. It was just an amazing feeling of, you know, the two sides of Berlin getting back together, you mm-hmm. know. And it was just, didn't last long, but it was just an amazing feeling. I've mm-hmm. never felt anything like it. It was just one big brotherhood, if you will.
Yeah.
Just an amazing sensation.
And then shortly thereafter, 18 months, 2 years later, Soviet Union's gone.
Soviet Union is gone. And it was gone from East Berlin much more rapidly than that.
Yeah.
I mean, they started pulling out almost immediately.
Yeah.
Big convoys hitting east.
As a veteran of the Cold War, how do you feel about that? The kind of sense of satisfaction do you have?
Oh, it's a real sense of satisfaction. We had really been vindicated. You know, it was really a war of two systems, two mm-hmm. cultures, mm-hmm. two different kinds of beliefs about human beings and how they should be treated, and our way prevailed. And of course, we like to say freedom won. And if you had seen the reaction to the Stasi, you would know how true that is. How enraged the East Berliners were at anything having to do with Stasi, mm-hmm. how badly they wanted revenge and, to do to the Stasi what the Stasi had done to them all those years. And,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, it was really a good feeling after the uncertainty kind of settled down. And of course, a lot of, you know, what's going to happen to the Soviet Union now that this has happened.
Mm-hmm.
The writing was kind of on the wall that. You know, it was coming down pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a full colonel there. He was an MI, military intelligence guy. He had been in Berlin as a second lieutenant when the wall went up.
Oh, wow.
And now he was there as a full colonel when it came down.
Hmm.
So that was a, hearing him speak was kind of an interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just an amazing, amazing time.
And you got some souvenirs from the wall, didn't you?
Oh, we've got a couple hundred pounds of the wall.
How'd you get that?
We went down and chipped it off with hammers.
Wow.
And, I mean, it was an interesting sensation. Before it came down, there were observation towers all periodically on our side of the wall that were accessible. And you could just walk up and climb one of these towers. In the city, the wall was a single wall. And there was a dead space on the other side, and then there was wire
mm-hmm.
and guards so that the East Germans could not get right up to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of effort on their side to stop people from escaping, and a lot of monuments on our side to people that had been killed trying to escape.
The orders were shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill. And But we could climb up on these observation towers and look over. I mentioned in the city it was one wall. When you got out in the country a little bit, because this was a big circle around West Berlin, get out in the country a little bit, it was two walls, and there was a big space in between with not a blade of grass, nothing. All there was were, imagine clothesline poles with wire between them, and they would put a dog on a leash tied to that wire so he could run back and forth, attack dogs. They came out and raked it every night so that they could see footprints.
Wow.
And this was all, of course, to keep us out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our couple thousand guys were going to invade their five tank armies.
Right.
They were seriously concerned about that. But after it came down, both of those walls in the country were destroyed, were torn down.
Mm-hmm.
You could walk right through the checkpoints. We chipped off some. The prized part was anything with graffiti on it, paint or anything like that. We got a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my office, I've got a big chunk taken right from the wall at Checkpoint Charlie. But we would get in the car and drive out to wherever the wall happened to be, and with a hammer, just take chunks out or pick pieces up and et cetera. So,
wow. What role did Vietnam play in the Cold War?
Well, you know, it was kind of like, I think, very analogous to the Soviets in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it's a cliche that Afghanistan was the Soviets' Vietnam. And I think there's a lot of truth to that analogy. And I think that, you know, Vietnam gave the Soviets a chance to kind of poke us in the eye without, quote, being directly involved, unquote. Although I think I mentioned we found ample evidence that there were Soviet advisors in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we knew they were in North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And, Soviet equipment, Chinese equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, North Vietnam was, in a way, their proxy. And it was a chance for them to gain some political advantage in the Cold War. Of course, our side was that we were trying to stop the advance of communism, mm-hmm. not the Soviets per se, but the advance of communism, mm-hmm. keep them from taking over a country that didn't want to be taken over.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we did it for our own national interest. And so I think it was an advantage for them in the Cold War. Probably the biggest advantage that it gave them was what it did to our society and to our army. The phrase at the time was hollow army, and unfortunately it was probably a true statement. And thanks to Ronald Reagan, we recovered rather well. But I think it gave them a real advantage in the Third World, in countries that may have been trying to walk the fence between the two superpowers. Mm-hmm. I think it definitely made some of them lean, you know, we were defeated.
Mm-hmm.
We pulled out with our tail between our legs, and I think that it gave them a real propaganda advantage,
mm-hmm.
in that context.
Briefly, let's talk about the end of your military career.
Okay.
We talked about the passing over deal. We'll skip that. Once you had that news, did you try again for the second time?
No. Well, you don't have any choice. You're considered
automatically.
Automatically, but I started the retirement process. Your chances of getting picked up a second time are like 3%.
You're in Berlin when this is going on?
I'm in Berlin, yeah. And so I started the retirement process almost immediately. I had a girl in college and another girl getting ready to go to college. So I couldn't, if I had retired from Berlin, I would have come back as a retiree without a job or anything else. And so if you make a change of station at government expense, you incur a one-year obligation. And so I went ahead and figured, okay, I'm going to need that long to find a job, et cetera.
Sure.
So we made the decision to come back. And,
this is 91 or 90?
90. Okay. 90. And I asked for and got an assignment to Fort Hood. I was from Texas. My mother was living in San Antonio at the time. And she was getting on. And we wanted to retire in Texas anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back and went to Fort Hood. Mm-hmm. I signed into Fort Hood the same exact day Saddam signed into Kuwait.
Really?
Yeah, that day.
Wow.
And I became the head of the maintenance division at Three Corps headquarters.
Okay.
It is, as we delicately phrase it, I was a staff puke. We immediately started trying to get our units ready, the Three Corps heavy units, the armor divisions, to go to the Mideast.
Mm-hmm.
And
so all of a sudden, you've got to start big-time war logistics.
Big-time war logistics, and get these units ready to move. We had to take all the armored vehicles and paint them with what we called CARC, which is chemical agent resistant coating.
Mm-hmm.
It was a paint that would resist chemicals and that would allow chemicals to be washed off and decontaminated more easily than standard paint, which would absorb absorb the chemicals. Mm-hmm. So we had to run all them through, and we had to paint them in desert colors. I mean, we were fully ready for a war in the forest, and so we had to repaint them from camouflage green and black to desert sand camouflage and the chemical agent resistant paint. And so we started running tanks through this one paint facility, and they came out pink.
Really?
Really. And the division was doing it, and the installation maintenance people were doing it. Division commander came down and said, "You must be kidding. I am not taking pink tanks to war. Repaint them." And they mixed up a new batch of paint and repainted them brown.
Was that done on purpose,
Steve? No. No, it was purely, we had no idea how they were going to come out until they actually rolled out the other end. And, pink tanks.
That wouldn't have done well in the desert.
Not well. And so we really kind of crashed and burned. And we were fighting a couple of problems at the time. One was the air filters on the tank engines, which are big, huge things, and they ingested sand and plugged up the air system. We needed a whole bunch of those. We had a problem with, they were, of course, diesel fueled, and an M1A2 tank has two fuel tanks. Well, they would use one tank fairly consistently, the fuel in the other tank would grow algae. And that would, it's called bloom, and it would plug the fuel filter, so they would only be able to use one tank. Well, an M1 tank gets about 4 gallons to the mile. Tank fuel is fairly critical. So we were fighting that problem. Mm-hmm. A couple others that we had to resolve.
Did you overcome all of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then shipped all the equipment down to all the equipment down to Houston, the port of Houston. Loaded that on ships and shipped that over. The troops came back, continued training until the equipment almost was there, and then they flew over.
This is Desert Shield.
Desert Shield, yes. Mm-hmm. And this was before Desert Storm actually started. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just an eternal amazement to me that Saddam got to the Saudi border and stopped.
Why?
I just cannot imagine what he was thinking. I mean, the Saudis had a brigade. We had sent over the 82nd Airborne, and about all they could have done to a Soviet tank was throw rocks. The Iraqis had Soviet equipment.
Yes.
100% Soviet equipment. But all they could have done to an Iraqi tank was throw rocks at it. Mm-hmm. And that's a slight exaggeration, but not much. I mean, he could have rolled across Saudi Arabia very quickly and taken out our major logistical base. And he just got to the border and stopped.
Is that at Riyadh?
Riyadh was one of them, yeah.
Okay.
And
why do you think he stopped?
I think he thought we weren't going to really take the whole thing very seriously.
And that he could kind of keep Kuwait under the rug. And
If he stopped at the Kuwait border and did not invade Saudi Arabia, it wouldn't piss us off too much. We wouldn't do anything.
And he claimed that Kuwait was a lost province, part of the original Iraq or Persia, and hence it was, but Saudi Arabia was not. Mm-hmm. So he would lose that argument right there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I was at Hood while this was going on, and it was amazing. You know, as a Vietnam vet who came home from Vietnam, I never personally had any trouble, but any war riots, soldiers reporting being spit on and called baby killers and all this kind of stuff. And the support during Desert Shield and Desert Storm was so amazing. I mean, people just could not do enough for us. It was incredible. You know, when we came back from Germany, we had like an RV, and I had bought a travel trailer. Mm-hmm. And we got all wrapped up and getting ready to ship the units over. And when you buy an RV, you get about 50 different warranty cards you have to mail in. I never got mine shipped in or mailed in. And a while later, I mailed them in with a letter that said, "I'm sorry they're late. you know, we were, I'm a soldier, we were doing that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I got a letter back that said, God bless you guys. Don't worry about your warranty. You are fully 100% covered. We love you guys. Be careful.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is you. You're not going to be deployed.
And I'm not even deployed. No, I'm at Fort Hood, Texas.
And you're riding out the last year here.
Yeah. And
it's a huge way to go out, though.
And I mean, the support. Lee Greenwood came to Fort Hood and sang his song. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing. And
how did that make you feel?
Great. Oh, it just made me feel great.
Not bitter.
Not bitter at all. Not bitter at all. It just made me feel great. And we thought we were going to go. Three Corps headquarters, we were told, you know, you're going in 2 weeks.
Well, what would happen to your enlistment? Or your time left?
Retirements were frozen. And they did this a little while ago in Iraq, too. It's called stop loss.
Right, right.
Retirements are frozen. People who are serving out their time, getting out of the Army are frozen. How can you complain?
It's very controversial for people today.
Yeah. How can you complain? You know, I mean, the country needs me. You know, hard to complain, and I didn't want to snivel about my retirement, you know. Turns out I retired on time anyway, because mm-hmm. the war was so short.
Right.
But it was just an amazing feeling. And,
you were watching troops leave and then some come back, and mm-hmm. then just the general support around the base and mm-hmm. in the town.
Well, you know, once they all got deployed, man, there wasn't a heck of a lot for us to do.
Right.
I mean, everybody was gone. The base was a ghost town.
What did you do?
And not much.
When actual Desert Storm started mm-hmm. in January 91, what were you doing? You're at Fort Hood.
I'm at Fort Hood and had been there several months.
Did you all know the shooting war was getting ready to start?
No. Well, I'm sure the CG did, but down at my level, we didn't. No, we had no idea. I got most of what I knew from CNN. And like I said, we were just standing on one leg, waiting to be deployed. They wound up sending 7th Corps out of Europe instead. And we had a real, real problem in 3rd Corps. The CG told the Chief of Staff that our aviation brigade was ready to deploy. Let's go. And come to find out that wasn't true. They weren't ready.
Really?
And their equipment status was such that they really couldn't deploy. So the CG had to call the Chief of Staff of the Army and say, never mind. Not a pleasant call. I'm glad I wasn't there.
Who was responsible for that aviation? Oh, you don't have to name the name, but...
Well, you know, it was a combination of the aviation brigade commander and the G4, my boss, and the Corps commander, and certainly the Corps commander should have known it, and the aviation brigade commander should have been telling him. He looked at their readiness reports, they were ready. You know, but the reports were wrong. Mm-hmm. And, when push came to shove, they just weren't ready.
You would have gone over, is that correct?
No, they would have sent the brigade separately.
Okay.
But I believe, and this is purely personal opinion, had that not happened, they would have sent us instead of 7th Corps headquarters. But I think that left such a sour taste about 3rd Corps in their mouths at DA that they elected to send 7th Corps instead. Okay. And out of Europe, and so anyway, we thought we were going to, and I mean, we were fully prepared. We had done the processing and everything, and then they sent 7th Corps, and we knew we weren't gonna go then. And like I say, it was, I mean, nothing to do.
Did you figure that? Yeah, now I'm probably gonna retire on time.
Well, no.
Oh, because it was still frozen.
Well, it was still frozen.
Okay.
And but when they had a 3-day, 100-hour war, and the Iraqis collapsed so quickly, and then we made the decision not to go into Iraq and chase Saddam, then I figured, okay. And sure enough, just a couple weeks later, they had ended stop loss. They were encouraging people to retire. They were facing a major rift to try and get the Army officer corps down to the post-Cold War size. In fact, my boss, when you're promoted, you are required to serve X number of years after you're promoted. And they waived that for him, mm-hmm. so he could retire as a full colonel mm-hmm. without serving that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And some lieutenant colonels and colonels were getting letters that, you know, we appreciate your interest in national defense, but it's time for you to retire. And
did you get one?
No, did not. And I wanted to retire before I got one. I mean, it was obvious my career was at an end. You know, I didn't get promoted. I was assigned to a staff duty kind of job. And I knew I was never going to have another assignment with troops.
How did you feel about all this?
Oh, I was pretty upset. I was very depressed, very saddened. I hated to go out that way, but, I mean, you know, that's the way life is.
Would you have continued, you know, as a full colonel and then to a brigadier? And
probably not. If I'd have made full colonel, that probably would have been it.
What month did you get out in 91?
I retired in, I actually left Fort Hood in September of 91, using accumulated leave, and officially retired in October 1st of 91. That was my official retirement date.
And how soon did you start working for Texas Tech?
I immediately. I had come up while I was still on active duty to interview, and gotten accepted, and so I left Fort Hood, came up here, started work the next day.
Wow.
And Diana and the kids stayed there and closed out the house. When they came up, one girl was away in college.
Where was she going?
She was going to Memphis State. Good, solid academic reason for going to Memphis State. That's where her boyfriend went.
The officer said it's a good school. Okay, anyway.
And when they came up, Diane and Kathy came up. Then I took a couple weeks off, and we took a little vacation. I came back and went to work.
Okay. Let me ask you, let's swing back to Vietnam.
Sure.
And let's talk just briefly about that before we end the interview. You walk into a college classroom right now. What do you tell this generation, the younger generations of Americans today, about the Vietnam War? What are the things that you would want to communicate to them about that conflict?
The biggest thing I'd want to say is we went for the right reasons. It wasn't just an adventure for the United States. It wasn't just an attempt to conquer other countries. You know, we really thought that we were going to stop the spread of communism. Communism was our enemy. That was a war between us and them. We wanted and needed to stop them everywhere we could, and that's why we went to Vietnam. We went for the right reasons. I'm not going to say that we went there to free the South Vietnamese. We went there to stop communism. That's one thing.
Okay.
The second thing I would tell them is don't forget what we learned. We kind of screwed it up. We can't fight a war without popular support, and we lost that support. And, you know, I've talked about what I think are the reasons for that, but,
yes.
The fact is we lost that support. A big part of the reason we lost that support is we didn't have clear goals. We didn't have a clear exit strategy. How do we know when we won that war?
The Powell Doctrine.
The Powell Doctrine, yeah. Those kinds of things.
We're from a man who did two tours, one of which was, you know, pre-major ground troops as an advisor, company commander, walking through the jungles of Vietnam and seeing this stuff firsthand,
yep.
Articulating what you just did.
Yep, and a brilliant man articulating that. And, you know, I hope that, and I believe that we learned some things from that, and we can't forget those things.
Pat, to play devil's advocate again, mm-hmm. Just to have more discussion
sure.
on this, isn't that a no-brainer when you go into war? Shouldn't the command authority of the United States be able to say, you know, okay, what are our goals? How do we know when we've achieved them? And how do we leave?
Well, it would seem that way. It would seem to be a no-brainer, but... how many consecutive presidents were not able to do that?
Both.
Or at least never did it?
Both parties.
Both parties. How many consecutive... of course, at that time, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was essentially powerless. But how many consecutive chiefs of staff of the Army never did that? Mm-hmm. It seems like a no-brainer, but we certainly did not do it. And that was a failure on our part.
Who do you lay the blame of Vietnam at the feet at? Or can you not do it at one individual? Do you have to do it at several?
Well, you know, it was... it's just like Br'er Rabbit and the Tar Baby, you know? Successive presidents latched onto it and then couldn't let go, starting with Kennedy. And you know, Kennedy grabbed a little bit and got stuck a little bit. And Johnson grabbed a whole bunch and got stuck a whole bunch. And Nixon grabbed a little and got stuck a little. You know, I can't say that there was any one person. There was never one president that was smart enough to say, okay, here's how we win this war, or we're not going to put into it what's necessary to win this war, we're going to get out. And just get out, not peace with honor and Vietnamization and that kind of thing. I truly think Nixon had the right idea in bombing North Vietnam, in invading Cambodia. Those were the kinds of things we needed to do to win the war.
In 1965,
66, 67? Then too. I understand why we never sent ground troops into North Vietnam. You know, we had to be careful with the Chinese. We did not want to get into war with the Chinese. We do not want to get into war with the Chinese. I'm not saying we'd lose it, but it'd be messy. But we certainly could have taken the war to them. And by the time Nixon was ready to do that, it just was politically not feasible politically. He just couldn't do it politically.
What else would you tell a class? You've got, we need to fight wars with popular support. We have to have the backing of the population in general. And that when we go into a conflict, know what we're doing. And have, you know, that Vietnam, here's what we should do. Vietnam, we didn't do, right?
Exactly. And look at Iraq, you know. There is a government forming a constitution. Once that constitution is written and adopted and they have a government in place and they have a security structure in place, we leave. Mm-hmm. They want us out. We want to get out. You know, I really think if the insurgents were smart, and they're not, but if they were, they would just stop. They would lay low. They'd let the government form. They'd let us go home, and bam, then they'd come out. But if they were smart, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. But I would also tell any class today, be careful how you treat your soldiers. You know, they have a choice about being in the Army. They don't have a choice about where they're fighting. They're defending their country, you know, and I think we've learned that lesson.
Is that from Vietnam?
From Vietnam. And boy, the pendulum really swung during Desert Shield and Desert Storm, I'm happy to say.
Were you surprised that it swung that heavily?
I really was. I didn't really know what to expect, but I did not expect it to go that far.
I wanted to always put this question out there to everyone who's interviewed for the Vietnam Archive World History Project is, are there any other things that you would like to comment upon that we have not commented upon? Any thoughts? And I have a couple of very short follow-up questions after this, but just in general, do you have anything else that you want to add to your story?
The only thing I want to say is what I've said before, and that is don't forget. Don't forget the lessons. They're bitter lessons. They're hard lessons. They were immensely hard on the country and the people of the country and on the Army and the military as a whole. And those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Don't forget that history.
Right.
Don't let the bitterness of it push it down and let it be forgotten.
Okay. you belong to any veteran associations?
I'm a lifetime member of the 1st Cavalry Division Association.
Okay. Do you attend reunions?
No, I really haven't. Probably for the same reason I don't read the books. Probably for the same reason I really have no interest in going back to Vietnam. I had what I considered to be a good tour. You know, I didn't get hurt. And I didn't have any casualties among my soldiers that directly worked for me. Mm-hmm. But it's an uncomfortable time for me. It's because of what happened, not there, but here. And it's just not something I particularly want to relive.
Perfect lead into this question, and I want you to feel free to speak very, very freely and candidly about this. How has it been to do this interview and talk about your Vietnam experience in detail? Of course, this is one chapter of a very successful military career you had of serving the country. But how has it been conducting an oral history interview with us to talk about Vietnam?
Intensely interesting. Very, very interesting. I have thought about things that I have not thought about in 35 years. Memories that I have not thought about in 35 years have floated to the top. I've learned some things about myself that I didn't know.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I frankly had never realized how much of an influence General Hawk has had on my life. I mean, I knew it.
Right.
But I never stepped through it like I did here, and how much of an influence he had. I knew I had an interesting military career. I didn't realize some of the things I've seen and done that most people don't get to see and do, and how much history I've been able to see. You know, if I can digress for a moment, of course, driving through France. Not talking about Paris.
Right.
Okay. If you take the Parisians out of Paris, it's a great place. But once you get outside of Paris, driving through Falaise, where we had the Falaise pocket during World War II, every little French town has a monument to the U.S. soldiers, usually to Patton. Driving through France on a toll road, we got off the toll road. And we have some, Diana has some old family friends that live near Verdun. What an interesting place.
Wow, yeah, history.
Oh, man. But we get off the toll road, and the French government gives a lot of civil service jobs like that to their old soldiers. And there was an old French soldier, he's wearing his ribbons on his suit, and bonjour, monsieur soldat and madame.
Were you in uniform?
No, but I had a huge American car and American license plate.
Sure, sure.
I mean, it was obvious we were Americans.
Right, and you have your ID.
Yeah, and he could just see us and know, you know, this old man, obviously a World War II veteran and a soldier because he had this job. And he just greeted us so warmly and so friendly. And that was a neat experience. I remember it to this day. And just a neat life, a neat experience, neat career. Verdun was interesting. It was an interesting life. Yeah.
Well, talking about Vietnam, has it settled anything for you?
I don't know that it has. I think it probably has helped. But, you know, still mixed feelings. We lost the war. That's hard to accept, even in this day and age, even this many years later. You know, as an ex-soldier, a retired soldier, that's a bitter pill. And it's made me think a lot about a lot of things and think about some things in a different way. And I don't know that it's really resolved it yet. I think it may have given me some insights with which to solve some things.
Okay. Well, Pat, is there anything else you want to add to what we've been talking about?
Just that... I appreciate more than I can say the opportunity to do this. It has been a great opportunity. I look forward to reading more of the interviews. I've looked at some, reading more of the interviews that you have online, mm-hmm. And I appreciate very much what you guys are doing in preserving this piece of history from an individual soldier's point of view. I think it's a great contribution, and I know I'm not the only one that appreciates what you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and on behalf of the Vietnam Archive staff and all of us that with the Oral History Project especially, thank you for your time and your articulation in doing this interview, your willingness to talk about Vietnam, talk about your career, and to share that with us now, but really to speak to generations coming up years and years into the future. So thank you very much for doing the interview, Pat.
Believe me, it was my pleasure.
And on behalf of the Vietnam Archive, as a non-political, apolitical statement, thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you very much.
Okay.